I'm Kayla Branch.
And I'm Nuria Martinez-Keel. You're listening to The Source.
Thanks for joining us as we discuss the Oklahomans' most impactful stories with the reporters who wrote them.
A third student has died from a vehicle crash near Moore High School.
Oklahoma City residents will vote on another sales tax proposal for parks.
The oil and gas industry looks at new water sources. We have high school sports reporter Cameron Jordan with us. Cameron, thank you for joining us as we remember a third student who has died from the Moore High School track team. Colby Crum died Saturday morning from injuries he suffered February 3rd when a driver struck a group of student runners near Moore High School. Cameron, you wrote a story memorializing Colby. What did you learn about him this week?
I learned too much that I couldn't even put it all in there that I wanted to. Really, in talking with some of his old coaches, friends, and just people around Moore, because he seemed to be everywhere. He had a couple places that he frequented all the time. He was always at DZ Comics and Gaming. He liked to go there and play games all the time. And apparently one of the things that he would do when he was there is he'd always go get a milkshake right before the cafe closed and, and do something like that. But he obviously made a lot of connections there, made a lot of friends there. He also, obviously being in the track team, he ran a lot. I've had multiple people tell me this, that he wasn't always the best runner, the fastest runner, anything like that, but he was always someone who outworked everybody. That's kind of what I come to find out about him, is he was pretty darn competitive in about everything he did. It didn't matter whether it was playing video games, whether it was in class, anything really. He tried to make sure that he was the first, the best, working the hardest to get toward that goal. And that just kind of goes, like, his competitiveness went into his work ethic too. He really strived to make sure everyone felt included. On the Prayers for Colby Facebook page, which started when he first went to the hospital and has been providing updates throughout, kind of his progress when he kind of got a little bit better and then kind of declined there toward the end. They posted a post, said, "Hey, share your favorite Colby memory," and multiple ones on there said from different students who'd either been to Moore High School. There were a couple of teachers who had saw it as well, and this really stood out to me. There were multiple posts on there that said Colby would go if there was someone who was at lunch. someone who was at lunch sitting alone, he would go out of his way to go sit down with them, start talking with them, get to know them a little bit. So that was pretty. That just kind of shows you the kind of guy he was. He was really, I don't want to say outgoing, but he really made sure that he wanted everyone to feel included. He did the same thing with the track team. The junior high track team at Moore would come over from the couple of middle schools and run with them in the afternoon. And he would make it seem to those middle schoolers like they're on the varsity team. He didn't want them to feel like they were being shunned because they were younger or anything like that. He just did a bunch to try to bring them in and include them, make sure that they felt included and make sure that they knew that, hey, you are a part of the team. It doesn't matter how old you are. You're being held to the same standard as we hold ourselves to. So, I mean, he's just, like I said, I kind of had a line in there. He led by example with his competitive spirit and his unrelenting work ethic, and that's kind of a little bit of what I learned about him, and I didn't even get to talk with a quarter of the people that he had an impact with on his life.
Yeah, and Colby had aspirations of running in college, so talk a little bit about, you know, his future plans that he was working toward.
Yeah, you know, the Wednesday after the accident, so only 2 days after the accident, he had planned on signing with Redlands Community College out in El Reno and was going to run on the cross-country team. And I actually called the coach out there because I wanted to figure that they would have had a little bit of a bond. I mean, he was going to sign there. They must have had some sort of unique relationship. And you know, she told me that just because junior college, you have such a limited amount of scholarships you can give out. And a lot of times you can't give a full scholarship. Well, like I had mentioned before, Colby wasn't always the best runner, wasn't always the fastest runner, but he worked hard. And he had originally sent an email to the coach and said, "Hey, I'm interested in running. What do I need to do?" And so she liked it, brought him in on a visit and everything. When he showed up for the visit, the original plan was to have him go through the visit and everything, and she was going to say, "Hey, we don't have a scholarship for you, but we're going to offer you a walk-on spot. We want you a part of our team," because of the passion he showed, how much it showed them that to the coach, to the teammates who were already there. It's like, man, this kid is really serious. And Natalie Cox, who's the coach, she was so moved from the time the visit started to the time the visit ended. I don't remember how long it was in talking with her. She was so moved by that time that by the time the visit was over, she had offered him a full ride scholarship.
Wow.
Just because of like, here's a quote from the story. He had that much of an impact on me during the visit. It was just his passion and his excitement for the sport. You could tell that he had a huge heart and that he absolutely loved doing it. And so it just kind of shows in that little bit of time on a visit, he went from probable walk-on, because he was good enough to run in college, to someone who's going to get a full-ride scholarship. And then probably from Redlands would have gone on to another college to finish up his running career too. So that's his plan was to go to college. Like I said, he was supposed to sign Wednesday, a couple days after the accident, and same with Rachel, who was supposed to sign with the Wichita Baptist. But yeah, he had planned on running in college.
Right, and like you mentioned, two students already died from the same crash. 17-year-old Rachel Freeman died at the scene, and 16-year-old Yuridia Martinez died the next day. How has the school and the track team especially been affected by this third tragic loss?
I talked with Chad Mashburn, who's Moore's site athletic director this morning, actually, and went over and gave him a hug and asked how they were doing. And, you know, it's a new normal for them, unfortunately. It's something that they haven't had to deal with before. And obviously you never want to deal with this at anywhere, but especially at the high school level, it's crazy to even think about it. So, you know, there's been, and Oklahoma's like this, there's been such a huge community support for Moore High School, the Moore track team. People have made shirts for them. They've hosted fundraisers for them. They've done so much to let them know, like, hey, we're here for you. Like, let us know what you need. It's tough on the administrators. Obviously, they've talked about it. Colby's funeral is tomorrow, Thursday, and you know they're obviously not looking forward to that, having to bury another student, having to do that. But the track team, I mean, they're kind of getting along about as well as you can. They lost three teammates, friends, people that they've grown up with their entire life. It's going to be interesting to see kind of what they do this season, because it's going to be, like you said, or like I was saying, it's a new normal for them. This is something that they haven't dealt with. It's new adversity that they have to get by. And, I mean, frankly, if you look at it, they lost some of their best runners who were leaders, who people look up to. So it's going to be tough. But, you know, I think for a situation like this, they're doing about as well as you can.
And going forward, police said Max Leroy Townsend, who is the man who reportedly struck the students with his vehicle and was intoxicated at that time, he was charged with two counts of first-degree manslaughter and leaving the scene of an accident after the deaths of Rachel and Yuridia. And prosecutors filed a third count of manslaughter and leaving the scene after Colby passed away. So we're going to have reporters following that court case as it goes forward. And Cameron, thank you so much for joining us and telling us what you learned about Colby this week.
Yeah, I really appreciate you guys having me on to talk a little bit about him.
We've got city reporter Bill Crum here with us to discuss an upcoming ballot initiative in Oklahoma City that would create a dedicated sales tax to increase funds for park maintenance. Bill, thanks for being here with us.
Thanks for having me.
This sales tax is going to be on the ballot on Super Tuesday, March 3rd. So just to start, could you give us a bit of background on the Parks Initiative and on the man behind the movement?
Well, it got off to kind of a rocky start last summer. They started collecting signatures, and then they had to stop and restart the initiative campaign. You could go back even farther, but that's for another time. They gathered almost 8,000 signatures. They needed 6,499 valid signatures in order to qualify for the ballot. City Council was compelled by state law to put it on the ballot, and they decided to put it on the March 3rd ballot, which I think is the first election that it could have been on. Like you said, is a citizens-led initiative. Former Councilman Ed Shadid and former Councilman Pete White are working on it. There's great need, from their perspective, a great need for improvements in neighborhood parks in the city. And anybody who drives around knows anybody who looks at the national rankings of cities and their parklands knows that Oklahoma City ranks near the bottom.
Yeah, and do we know about how much money per year this sales tax initiative would raise?
Yeah, it's an eighth of a cent sales tax, and it's analogous to the eighth of a cent that voters approved some time ago for the Oklahoma City Zoo. Would raise, you know, depending on whether it's a good year or a bad year, somewhere in the neighborhood of $12 to $14 million a year.
Okay. Definitely. And, you know, Oklahoma City residents just passed a MAPS 4 sales tax initiative in December, which includes $140 million just for parks. But talk a little bit about the difference between, you know, what the MAPS 4 money is going to be used for and the reason that folks are still pushing for the sales tax initiative, which will be used for maintenance costs.
Well, the program that was passed in MAPS 4, like you said, is $140 million. It is, I think it was the biggest single part of the MAPS 4 package of the 16 projects that were in that. It includes $63 million for neighborhood parks, which is what the Citizens Initiative is aimed at. And it includes money for the way it was sold to sort of spiff up parks, plant trees, you know, things like that. The Citizens Initiative goes further than that and includes provisions to improve programming at parks, be that baseball leagues, soccer programs on Saturday mornings for little kids, yoga classes. One of the things we talked about yesterday, I talked to the parks director, Doug Cupper, about this on Wednesday afternoon, and he mentioned Zumba.
Zumba.
frankly, I don't know a whole lot about it, but apparently it's very popular. And pickleball also, which is popular with older residents, and they can't get enough space for pickleball in the new MAPS 3 senior health and wellness centers. They're just crazy about it. So programming, you know, there's a real push in the Citizens Initiative for programming, A, and B, it's a dedicated sales tax. And I think, as you know, the budget for 2021, which will be passed and go into effect on July 1st, includes cuts to the park's general fund budget. And if citizens approve the initiative, or if voters approve the Citizens Initiative, I should say, that money is dedicated to parks. It can't be cut. It goes to parks just like the money goes to the zoo and has helped, you know, the zoo keep admission prices down and programming up.
Right. And just as you were just talking about, city departments were told to prepare for cuts in their next budgets. The Parks Department specifically was told to find $519,000 in savings. Why are city leaders bracing for reductions, and how could the sales tax proposal help with that?
Well, all the projections are, and you see it at the state level with what was approved by the Board of Equalization this week, is that the Oklahoma economy is slowing, and the Oklahoma City economy is still, despite the efforts to diversify, dependent to a great extent on oil and gas. One of the measures that the economists look at very closely is the number of oil and gas rigs that are active in the state. It's down to around 50, you know, and I think something a year ago was more like 125. That's a metric that they are beginning to wonder about a little bit, because oil and gas production is up, even though the number of active rigs is down. But the upshot of all that is that employment is expected to drop in Oklahoma City in the oil and gas industry. And the city is very dependent on sales tax. If employment is expected to go down, and in fact, it began going down at the end of 2019, fewer people working means less money in the economy and less money to spend in the stores. And if people aren't shopping, sales tax is going to go down.
Yeah. And you've written that this is a citizen-led initiative. And so and we were just talking earlier about why we haven't heard too much from city leaders on this. But tell us again, why are city leaders staying kind of quiet on supporting or not supporting this measure?
Well, they're prohibited from supporting or not supporting things like this. And you can look at MAPS, for instance. MAPS campaigns are run by the Greater Oklahoma City Chamber, which is the city's largest business organization. And that's because, it's because they support it. But the city is prohibited from campaigning for, and I suppose against, anything like this, you know, be it MAPS, be a citizens initiative or whatever. They're supposed to remain neutral. They can provide information to residents about what it's about, but they can't advocate one way or another. And they're very careful to avoid doing that.
Well, and you had said that you talked with Parks Director Doug Cupper. And what did he have to say about the initiative petition?
Well, Zumba, for one thing. One of the things that he acknowledged when I asked him was that the initiative in bringing in $12 to $14 million a year would increase the budget for the city park system by 50%.
Wow.
Which obviously is significant. You know, when you think about that, the budget now is worth about 2/8 of a cent, you know, out of the sales tax that is collected by the city. So you add another 1/8 of a cent, and the number of programs, the ability to refurbish community parks like Wheeler, for instance, which is a really interesting place. And he mentioned that he's talked to so many people who learned to play baseball, for instance, or do other things at Wheeler Park back in the day. And if you drive over there now, it's just a shell of his former self, and it's really kind of sad. And it's right on the Oklahoma River. And that could be lighted and reactivated, and he could do you know, that all over the city with the proceeds from that the tax that the initiative proposes.
Switching gears here a little bit, you're going to be covering the State of the City speech next week, which Mayor Holt will give on Wednesday. What do you expect him to cover in that talk?
Well, we don't know really yet. I'm going to talk to him on Friday, and I promised to give me a little bit more information about his major themes. One thing that we do know is that education, public schools, are going to be discussed. He's been promising since he was elected 2 years ago to figure out a way to involve the city, which does not run the public schools, as he, you know, points out every chance he gets, to improve the public schools, you know, contribute in some way to improving the public schools. And it sounds like he's going to announce some initiatives or ideas in the State of the City speech on education. I think that is what, you know, last year was MAPS 4. Mm-hmm. That was his first State of the City speech. I think this year education is, if not the centerpiece, it's going to be a big part of the speech. And I wouldn't be surprised if that initiative is really the centerpiece of his agenda for the next year.
Great. Well, Bill, thank you so much for joining us. Maybe we will run into you at a Zumba class in the future.
I hope so. I'm sure it would be good for me.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're excited to have business writer Jack Money with us. Jack, thanks so much for being here with us this week. And you covered a meeting earlier this week for the Oklahoma Water Resources Board where they adopted rules around brackish water. And this seems like a topic that is not widely known or discussed among the common population. So let's just start from the top and explain this to me like I'm five. What is brackish water?
Well, I guess I'd start off by saying that the first thing that probably a lot of folks who aren't directly involved in the oil and gas industry probably don't realize is that it takes a lot of water to be able to produce oil and gas, no matter where you're trying to produce it. But particularly over the past decade, oil and gas operators' water needs have climbed pretty dramatically as they've changed the way that they drill and produce for oil and natural gas. You know, a decade ago, if you look at the types of wells that were being drilled and produced, probably, you know, a significant portion of those were still what I would call retro wells these days. They were vertical in nature for the most part. And while some of them, you know, got to be fairly deep, you know, you were just basically punching holes in the ground, I guess, for lack of a better term. These days, we're drilling what we call horizontal wells. And some of these wells can, you know, extend thousands of feet in that horizontal plane, and you're trying to tap a geological resource in that given area where that well's going. And so the idea is you want to provide the most stimulation for that formation that you can. The way that we stimulate that formation is we hydraulically fracture it. And the way that these oil and gas producers are fracturing that rock is they're using water that's injected into the wellbore, you know, under some fairly high pressure. And then you add some kind of proppant, like usually it's sand, but it could be little plastic beads or something like that. But you want to provide some kind of proppant to support whatever fractures that you open up so that you can allow for a free flow of oil and gas into you know, these well bores and then produce it to the surface. So they're using a lot more water than they used to. Mm-hmm. And typically the way that they find this water is they'll get a permit through the Water Resources Board either to pull that water from, you know, a stream if there's one nearby, or they might go to a nearby landowner that, you know, has a significant piece of property. And, you know, under Oklahoma state law, they have the right to produce so much fresh water from their property. And then bring it up to the surface, and then it can be used for things like completing oil and gas wells. It also is used for other things like, you know, providing irrigation for crops. You know, the EPA defines potable water as groundwater that basically has total dissolved solids of between 0 parts per million and 5,000 parts per million.
Okay.
And usually between 0 and 100 parts per million, you don't need any treatment at all. I mean, you can bring it to the surface and you can drink it, and it's perfectly fine. Once you get above 100 parts per million, that starts impacting the water's clarity and its odor and its taste. And so you're going to start treating it. But then there was this water that we call brackish that's between 5 and 10,000 parts per million. So this water is treatable, you know, mm-hmm. to a certain extent today. And then we're thinking really long term between now and 2060, those technologies are going to continue to improve. which will provide more opportunities to come up with some beneficial uses for the water. The oil and gas industry was asking for it in the 2012 timeframe because the drought was so bad, and they were really hard-pressed to find the water that they needed to be able to complete these really big horizontal oil and gas wells that they were drilling. They went to the legislature and they went to the Water Resources Board and said, you know, we need some relief. And so the rule changes that the board adopted this week, which, by the way, still could be rejected by either the legislature or Oklahoma's governor, but I don't think either one of those things are realistically, you know, a possibility. But this gives the Water Resources Board the authority to, you know, regulate the production of this brackish water for beneficial uses. And it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, 10 years from now, when the treatment technology, you know, gets even better, that you might see them further expand that at some point in the future to say, hey, you know, now we're going to have the authority to regulate the production of this water to, you know, amounts where you're talking 60 or 70,000 parts per million.
Oh, wow.
You know, it'll take some time, but that's a very realistic possibility. But the whole goal behind all of it is to keep Oklahoma's freshwater use, which, again, is that water between 0 and 5,000 parts per million. They want to keep the amount of water that they're using that falls in that range the same in the year 2060 as what, you know, basically we're using now. So the idea is to conserve the best water that we have by using these alternative sources.
So when you talk about taking that brackish water, which, like you said, can be some nasty stuff when it once it comes out of the ground and it's mixed in with all these minerals, when you talk about beneficial purposes and beneficial uses of that water, could you give some examples of how we can use what has a higher concentration of am I saying that correctly, that minerals are in this water and that's really kind of what makes brackish water what it is? How can you take that and use it for purposes that maybe we would want to use freshwater purposes for?
You can mix it with freshwater is the primary thing that oil and gas operators have been doing with their produced water. They'll bring it up, and that water, which again is you know above 10,000 parts per million, it could be 10,001 or it could be, you know, 70,000 parts per million. It just depends on where it's being produced from. They will bring that water to the surface, and then they will mix it with fresh water to bring those total dissolved solid levels down to at least a point to where it's safe to work with, and then they will use that to you know go about their business of drilling and completing new wells, and that's primarily what they've been doing over the last, you know, probably, I don't know, 3 to 5 years.
So what they're trying to do is just reuse that water to mm-hmm. do more hydraulic fracking. That's the main purpose of what they would be basically recycling that water for.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's not like they're trying to convert that into drinking water or some other use of fresh water out there. It's really just reserved within fracking purposes.
Right. You will see on some of the nation's coasts and probably down in far south Texas examples of where governmental or even private entities are producing basically just straight salt water and then treating it with the technology that's available today to turn it into water that can be used for, you know, drinking purposes. But that's not real widespread. The technology is still pretty expensive. And there are a lot of economic factors that roll into that practice that have to work for you before you could actually say, okay, it's going to be, you know, feasible for us to provide this to our customers at an affordable price. And in Oklahoma, we're a long ways from being there.
Yeah. And so I'm curious, because about 5 years ago, Oklahoma started to have an uptick in seismic activity. There were hundreds of high magnitude earthquakes, more than we had seen, I think, you know, at least in recent memory, that type of seismic activity. And so this brackish water and what we're hoping the oil and gas industry is hoping to do with it, you know, how does that relate to concerns about hydraulic fracking and then the reinjection of wastewater, which is what actually causes the earthquakes? How does this all relate to that?
Well, it's pretty that's it's a pretty big mouthful to try to answer all of those questions. There really is no direct correlation between the number of earthquakes that we're seeing and the type of water that's being used to both, you know, drill and complete wells you know, the amount of water that, you know, is just generally getting produced for these purposes. There is a direct correlation between the numbers of earthquakes that we're seeing and the amount of water that's being disposed of, though. Geologists that I've talked to said that we saw the spike in seismic activity that we did because the amount of water that was being produced and disposed of had radically climbed. And again, that goes back, part of it goes back to the types of wells that were being drilled, but really what it was tied to was the formations that were being targeted for oil and gas production.
Well, Jack, we really appreciate you coming on and sharing your expertise in the oil and gas industry with us. Thanks again for explaining all of that for us.
Well, I appreciate you all inviting me in.
Thanks for joining us this week. You can read all these stories and more every day in The Oklahoman and at oklahoman.com. Check back next Friday for a new episode.